The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the NC Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Okay, let's start off with We Found a Fix, 9 Tricks to Improve Your Life. Number 1. Prevent cat litter odor. It may seem counterintuitive, but cat litter smells better when you use less of it. Instead of filling the litter box to the top, pour in just enough to cover the bottom of the box, about 2 inches. That way the litter will air dry quickly, and you can keep even the cheapest brand smelling fresh. For best results, scoop out waste daily and change the litter at least once a week. And the next one is Beat the Crowds, number 2. Look up where you want to shop today on Google Maps, and it will display a bar graph of the busiest times for that store. You can also look at other days of the week to see how traffic patterns change. Google gathers data from specific stores, so you can compare how busy the various Targets or Walmarts in the area are on any given day. Number 3. Put extra vino to good use. That's assuming, of course, you have extra vino. Fresh leftover wine and ice cube trays, 8 cubes equals 1 cup, to add flavor to future sauces, stews, and more. White and sparkly work best in creamy or clear soups, think chowder or simple vegetable, while red wine goes well with tomato or beef-based varieties, such as chili. Add about 1 ice cube per portion. Shut down stress. Number 4. If you're feeling overwhelmed, step outside or open a window. Researchers say getting more oxygen to the brain is a quick and effective stress reliever. Taking in a deep breath of fresh air can immediately shift your neurochemistry, says Debbie Serrani, PS, Doctor of Psychiatry, a psychology professor at Adelphi University, and the author of Living with Depression. The American Psychological Association recommends the fresh air approach, too. Number 5. Don't overfill your tank. A few more drops of gasoline can't hurt, right? Not so fast. The automatic shutoff valve is there for a reason. Gasoline needs room to expand, so topping off can cause pressure to build up in your fuel tank and lead to a dangerous leak. Better to just stop when the pump does. Number 6. Spend less on your hotel rooms. Weekend bookers tend to luck out when it comes to snagging the best rate. Prices are lowest on Fridays and Saturdays, according to the most recent data from the travel site kayak.com. Absolutely avoid booking on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays when the prices are the highest. Number 7. Don't crank the AC. When you get home on a hot day, do you drop the air conditioning way down so you can cool the place off quickly? The thing is, your AC can work only so fast. Setting it at 60 degrees Fahrenheit instead of your usual 75 will just waste energy. When you let the air conditioner keep cranking chilly air after the room has reached your ideal setting, you'll save on energy costs by keeping it set to your preferred temperature. Number 8. Speed through ironing. The hotter your clothes, the faster you'll blast away wrinkles, as long as you don't overdo it. One good trick, put a piece of aluminum foil under your ironing board cover. The foil will reflect some of the heat from the iron back up to the fabric and smooth out the wrinkles faster. And number 9, and this is important, make better small talk. Casual conversation should be playful, like a tennis game, not a job interview, says Jean Marnett, author of The Art of Mingling. So what do you do when you're stuck? Turn things into a game. Ask the other person to tell you a few details about his company, and then try to guess where he works. Games allow you to show more personality and your partner to get into the spirit, according to Martinet. All in a day's work. And there's a cartoon of a doctor with a lady sitting on the bench getting ready to be examined, and the doctor says, "Before you tell me about your diet, I should warn you. I follow you on Facebook." Teacher shared with Reddit.com the most questionable questions they had ever been asked. How old was the average 18-year-old in 1942? What are those pyramid-shaped things in Egypt called? If the patient has a brain hemorrhage, can we tie tourniquet around the neck to stop it? I asked the kids in my nursery school class what they needed in order to grow up nice and strong. One little girl answered, birthdays. Your true stories in 100 words or less. Okay, boys are allowed. I've been trying to prepare my 7-year-old daughter for a new baby in a few months, but she kept insisting, no boys in our house. When the big day arrived, my daughter came into the hospital room. I told her, the baby is a boy. What are we going to do? She placed both hands on her hips and without missing a beat said, I guess we'll just have to love the little thing. The Wild Bunch. While at a motel in North Dakota, I went to breakfast and sat by a gentleman who was on the phone. I heard him say that he had lost time yesterday because his passenger got cranky, so he stopped at a truck stop and hosed them down with cold water. Then I noticed a school bus in front of the motel that hadn't been there the day before. When the gentleman ended his call, I asked him if that was his bus. No, he replied, I'm in the back with a semi-load of pigs. That's interesting. Lost and found. My wife and I like to take walks down the quiet roads in our small town. One day we noticed a key on the road and hung it on a fence where the deflated birthday balloon had settled. We hoped that eventually someone would spot their missing key. A week later, we realized our shed key was missing. When we searched and searched and searched, but it was nowhere. Then a light bulb went on. Luckily, the remnants of that colorful balloon helped us spot it. We took it home for a test. Sure enough, we had lost and found our own key. Now, here's something that's important. How to feel happier today. A popular Yale University course now available for free online is chock full of valuable life lessons. And there's a balloon lying there with a big smiley face on it, bright yellow, very colorful. Well, I learned that the most popular course in the history of Yale University, a psychology class designed to teach students how to be happier, was available online to anyone who wanted to take it. I decided to see what it was all about. After all, I've been writing about happiness for years, offering techniques and advice from researchers who found that this idea or that habit can boost well-being. I was curious to see what Yale professor Laurie Santos was recommending, but I assumed I'd already be familiar with many of the concepts. So I invited my boyfriend Ian to take the course with me. I wanted to see how someone who hadn't heard it all before reacted. Santos' online course consists of 19 hours of video lectures and is supposed to take 10 weeks to complete. But Ian and I spent 3 months soaking up what she had to offer. We learned that the things we tend to think will make us happier, bigger paychecks, nicer homes, trimmer bodies, don't actually add joy to our lives. But practices such as exercising more, socializing, getting enough sleep, and prioritizing free time over making money do. These constant practices are really what's required to boost your happiness, Santos told me after Ian and I completed her course. It's like a tire that you put air into. Occasionally it leaks, and you have to put more air into it. It's not a one-time thing where you learn it and you're good. You actually have to put the work in. Although part of the course focuses on the desire to get good grades and land the perfect job, we realize that these lessons aren't helpful just for college students. Ian and I are both middle-aged, with 6 children between us, and most of what Santos said was relevant to us. What the science suggested is that those tips apply cross-culturally across ages, and no matter what job you have, Santos says. After taking the course, I'm convinced that anyone who adopts and practices the strategies that Santos suggests can truly become happier. Here are our favorite takeaways. Increase your social connections. Reconnecting with a friend can boost happiness, but so can a meaningful encounter with a stranger. One of the most complex things we can engage with another person's mind, says Julian Schroeder, an assistant professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and one of the researchers cited in the course. Ian loves chatting with waiters, and I noticed him doing it even more after we learned about the benefits of such interactions. He beams afterwards. Tim Bono, who teaches his own course on happiness at Washington University in St. Louis, offers this caveat. Facebook friends don't count. In fact, many studies have found that the more you use social media, the less happy you are. In this book, Happiness 101, Simple Secrets to Smart Living and Well-Being, Bono argues that this is because social media, especially picture-heavy platforms such as Instagram, showcases things that others have that we don't, making us want more and appreciate less. Santos echoes this idea in her course. She warns of ways our minds trick us into feeling less happy, such as by comparing ourselves to others who seem richer or more accomplished. And with the volume of carefully curated digital personas online, the comparison is far less likely to be favorable, or for that matter, even true. Perform acts of kindness. Volunteering to help someone or buying a coffee for the person behind you in line can make you happier than doing self-indulgent things, such as getting a massage or a pedicure. You just feel good about yourself as a person, says Sonia Lyubomirsky of the University of California, Riverside, another of Santos' sources. Whereas if you're treating yourself, it might actually lead to feelings of guilt afterwards. Varying your approach is key. If you perform the same act of kindness over and over, it may begin to feel like an obligation or a monotone chore. Ian and I held doors open for people, let extra cars merge in front of us on the highway, and help colleagues solve computer problems. The reactions we got made us feel better about ourselves, and they didn't cost us anything unlike indulgent massage. Kindness brings other happiness benefits, too, says Raj Rukamahathan. Where did they get all these long names? Author of If You're So Smart, Why Aren't You Happy? Helping others take the focus away from our own worries and problems, which can boost happiness. And because it doesn't result in the guilt that more self-serving behaviors can, being generous won't increase levels of the stress hormone cortisol. Perhaps surprisingly, kindness improves overall physical health. Unsurprisingly, healthier people tend to be happier. Burn some calories. Exercise causes hormonal changes in the body that make you feel good and help interrupt negative thoughts. According to research cited in Santos' course, clinically depressed people who exercise regularly improved just as much as those who took antidepressants. And after 10 months, the exercises were less likely to relapse. Getting out of a depression is not exactly the same as happiness, as D.K. Rangakrishnan, a professor of psychiatry at Rush Medical College in Chicago. But anecdotally, people who exercise will tell you they feel better. Anyone who has ever experienced a runner's high will agree. Get enough shut-eye. Just as shortchanging your sleep can make you grumpy, making time for sleep can boost your mood. A lot of people know that sleep is good, says Adam Krauss, a psychology fellow and doctoral candidate at UC Berkeley. But some are forced to sacrifice sleep because they have other things taking up their time. In fact, Ian and I tried to get more sleep during the course, but our busy lifestyles made it difficult. To include the course, Ian and I each had to commit to a happiness-promoting activity for 4 weeks. Ian decided to exercise more, and I decided to get more sleep. The first week, Ian went to the gym 4 times. During his initial visit, he texted me a treadmill photo because he was so excited to be there. That same week, I set an alarm signal to myself to get ready for bed. After a few days, I was so well-rested that I woke up earlier than usual to spend quality time with my teenage daughter while she got ready for school, and I was much more productive during the day. The remainder of our 4-week challenge didn't go as flawlessly, but when we kept up with our goals, we felt happier, and we walked away from the experience with the desire to follow through on our commitments. Ian bought a treadmill, and I have an alarm that rings when it's bedtime. The idea that you can make incremental plans in happiness is one of the reasons folks are so intrigued by the course, Santos says. You can work on it. In fact, you should. And let's see if they have any more information about that, because this sounds like something that would be fun to do. It's a Yale course. All it is a Yale University course. It doesn't say whether there's cost or anything else about it. 13 things, a crash course in commencement speeches. Why is it called commencement speech? The historical answer is that students in medieval times entered universities as apprentices and left able to commence their professions. The word commencement isn't the only relic from graduation ceremonies of yore. We've also kept the caps, the gowns, and yes, even the speeches. Number two, the earliest commencement speakers were graduating students who delivered their speeches in Latin. At Princeton University, the senior chosen to give the salutatory address still does it in Latin. The graduates receive special copies of the speech with instructions, in English, on when to laugh, in the hope that the rest of the audience will be impressed with the student's Latin fluency. Now, that's cool. Number three, while a commencement speech is meant to be significant to the graduates, sometimes it actually makes history. In 1947, Secretary of State George C. Marshall gave an address at Harvard University graduation that outlined a program to help European nations devastated by World War II. We know it today as the Marshall Plan. Prominent speakers come at a premium. Matthew McConaughey raked in $135,000 for the address he gave at the University of Houston in 2015. Katie Couric banked $110,000 at the University of Oklahoma. In 2006, for a 10-minute speech, that comes in more than $600,000 an hour. Geez, I always thought people did it voluntarily just with their expenses covered. That's kind of cheap, isn't it? Number five, that said, only 30% of universities pay their speakers. The rest rely on alumni or famous friends who will do it for free. Some forgo a paycheck in exchange for an honorary degree, but certain schools, such as Cornell University, don't award any. The Board of Trustees thinks they cheapen a hard-earned education. Number six, many colleges extend invitation to coveted speakers a year or more in advance. But securing a speaker early doesn't make the school immune to last-minute scramble. Just a month before its 2015 ceremony, Temple University announced that ESPN anchor Kevin Negandhi would be the commencement address in place of the school's original pick, Bill Cosby. Number 7. You don't have to be a human to give a graduation speak. Kermit the Frog gave the commencement address at Southampton College in 1996 and received an honorary doctorate in amphibious letters. Soon from the school, in 2012 at the University of Vermont, Tom Kenny and Bill Fagerblake delivered their speech as a dialogue between their better-known characters, SpongeBob SquarePants and Patrick Starr. That would have been cool. I would like to have seen that. Number 8. One of the most celebrated commencement speakers of late was billionaire investor Robert E. Smith, who gave the address at Morehouse College last year. Smith offered more than just words of encouragement. He pledged to pay off the student debt of all 396 graduates. Months later, Smith announced he would also foot the bill for the federal student loans their parents had taken out. Another famous benediction benefactor was Eugene Lang, who promised the 1981 sixth grade class at an old elementary school in Harlem that he would pay their college tuition as long as they graduated from high school. More than half of those 61 kids pursued higher education. Since then, Lang's National I Have a Dream Foundation has helped 18,000 disadvantaged students go to college. Number 10. When 8th grader Gwen Lynch graduated from her one-room schoolhouse in Cuttybunk Island, Massachusetts, last year, she was the only student in her class. She still got a big-time commencement speaker, actor Jenny Slate, who lived nearby. Slate later said of Lynch, "She goes to school by herself and still has more friends than I had as a teenager." In her 2017 speech at Langley High School in Virginia, author Lauren Graham recalled that her own graduation from the same school felt like an empty victory. In fact, the folder she received that day was empty. Graham didn't receive her diploma until she paid her library fines. She never returned Robinson Crusoe. Number 12. Even if you miss the ceremony, you can still enjoy a good graduation speech. NPR created an archive of more than 350 addresses called the Best Commencement Speeches Ever. But you'll have to read some of them, as NPR, get this, doesn't have all the audio files. Number 13. So what was the best commencement speech ever? There's a lot of support for Steve Jobs' address at Stanford University in 2005. Month after receiving a cancer diagnosis, Jobs told the graduates, Remembering I'll be dead soon helps me make the big choices in life, because almost everything, expectation, pride, fear of embarrassment or failure, falls away in the face of death, leaving only what, in truth, is truly important. Humor in uniform. During a combat medical training class, the topic of the blast injuries. At one point, our very intimidating instructor pointed out to me and said, "There's been a Jeep explosion. What would you do if you came upon an injured man with a steering wheel embedded in his chest?" Nervous and unsure, I blurted out, "Drive him to the hospital." For some reason, the rest of the room found this hilarious. It was our first day on the rifle range at Lackland Air Force Base. I felt confident as I am and squeezed the trigger of my carbine for my first shot. "Good news and bad news," my instructor said. "The good news, you got a bullseye." Before my head could swell too much, he added, "But it was in somebody else's target." And here we are with the food on your plate. I am butter, and we all love butter. Silky smooth and ready for any stage. Some foods were never meant to be liked. The lima beans of the world, the licorices, the powdered coffee creamers, those black bean little cakes that call themselves burgers, all born into sad saccharine, although I like lima beans. Me, though, I'm a superstar, a talented actor with celebrity charisma. I'm the one people gravitate to at the dinner party, the smooth one who inspires superlative idioms like, "Butter, baby," and gets featured in Andromache lit porches in Time magazine. So how come I'm slogging out with those other fats just to stay relevant? This just isn't right. When you've needed something silky and spreadable to moisten your bread, I've been there. When you've hankered for satiny sauces, I've melded myself right into them. As my old friend Julia Child put it, with enough of me, anything is good. And yet you've forsaken me. In my heyday, nearly a century ago, each of you Americans ate 20 pounds of meat per year. Now you're down to 6. Take that time cover from a few years back. That was actually a good moment for me. It was captioned, "Eat butter," which I obviously loved. Great photo, too. Did I mention the photo? I had survived the low-fat craze of the 80s and 90s, had endured falsy-faced margarine half-century in the sun, celebrating when she finally got locked away in health jail. Butter was back. The article said that as soon as it hit newsstands, Harvard University nutritionists and other wonks were so eager to tear me down again. They recommended moderation and reasserted that Sactimonious Chump extra virgin olive oil was healthier than me. I'm telling you, you gotta audition me again. I'm from the cream skimmed off the milk. Does it get any better than that? Cream contains tiny fat globules that float around, ignoring one another. Yet when you shake, beat, or churn them enough, amazing things start to happen. First, you incorporate air, whisking up whipped cream. Churn longer, and the fat globules start colliding and sticking together until blobs of golden dairy fat are floating in watery milk, buttermilk. Drain it and wash the milk with water. Give it a knead or two, add some salt or don't, and bada-bang, bada-boom, me. Among cooking fats, my genius dominates for a reason. I alone am an emulsion of fat, water, and milk solids. Being so emulsified, 80% fat in the United States and 82% in Europe, might sound like meaningless hokum to you, but this is wildly important in the kitchen. Every other fat you cook with, my friends, olive oil, canola oil, chicken fat, yada yada, is pretty much just fat. But if you dip lobster in melted butter, you know I contain multitudes. I'm the white foam on top, sugar and proteins, the cloudy liquid at the bottom, water, and the clear yellow stuff in between, clarified butterfat, or G. That's G-H-E-E. It's the way I shapeshift among those parts that makes me so good. I'm solid and firm when cold, so you can layer me into puff pastry or pie crust dough without making a squishy mess. When baked, I melt, leaving behind countless tender and flaky layers. I can be softened at room temperature, just enough to be creamed with sugar, trapping air that forms bubbles for the lightest cookie dough. By melting me very carefully to maintain my emulsified state, chefs made me the foundation of Sunny Hollandaise and Herbal Bernaise, just about every other classic sauce with body but no greasiness. I've always known when to act subtly. My ghee, unlike my easy-to-scorch milk solids, has a high smoke point and is very frying-friendly. So I'm the cooking fat in India and much of Southeast Asia, where I also play a significant role in religious rituals, including funerals. In Europe, I was first peasant fare, as the rich were well larded with poultry and pork fat. But when medieval Catholics okayed me for mealtime Lent, so I got a toehold in the upper-class diet and took France by storm. I even co-starred in the Protestant Reformation. One of Martin Luther's many gripes was a butter fee levied by the Pope. But then came the sad bits. Emperor Napoleon III ran low on butter for his troops, and put out a call for someone to approximate my sublime flavor and texture. Some diggers flavored milk with beef tallow, yuck, and a long line of poor imitations followed. Later, scientists altered vegetable oils to hydrogenate them, making them spreadable like, naturally, I am. Yes, margarine puts itself on stage. Butter rationing during World War II helped too, especially when the government allowed producers to add yellow coloring to its unappetizing pale gray shades. Read the headlines today about how I again outsell margarine, and you'd think I'd made a comeback. But my saturated fat continues to be a controversial indulgence in the face of healthier options like mono unsaturated fats and ho-hum olive oil. But live a little, would you? I'm butter, baby. And then there's a perfect beurre blanc. For an essential topping to fish, blanched vegetables such as asparagus or carrots or roast chicken or duck, combine 6 tablespoons of dry white wine, 2 tablespoons of white wine vinegar, and 1 very finely minced large shallot in a small saucepan and bring it to a simmer over medium heat. Lower the heat to a gentle simmer and cook until liquid is reduced to about 2 tablespoons. Cut 1 stick cold unsalted butter into 1 tablespoon pieces. Reduce the heat to the lowest setting and add 1 tablespoon butter. Whisk constantly until almost melted, then add another piece of butter. Make sure heat remains low, briefly removing saucepan from heat if necessary, so that the butter pieces just barely melt. Continue whisking in butter 1 piece at a time until all of it is incorporated in a silky, creamy sauce as formed. Season with salt and white pepper and serve immediately. Meatloaf again? As much as we complain about leftovers, humans have been stuck with them since practically forever. In fact, in a cave in Israel, scientists recently found dried deer marrow that's believably the oldest catch of store food. It has been there for as many as 400,000 years. Think it's still good? I won! Mackinac Island Stone Skipping Tournament. Maxwell Steiner, age 28, Las Vegas, Nevada. What do people say when you say you're a champion rock skipper? They don't believe it at all. I was actually at a wedding this past weekend, and I was talking to somebody, and he was just blown away. It's a great conversation starter, that's for sure. Because you're a grown man who gets worked up about skipping rocks, it gets pretty intense, to be honest. People do take it seriously. I like to have more fun. Do you bring your own rocks, or do the competition supply them? I actually bring a case full of them, about 50, so I can practice a little bit before. I like bigger stones, about the size of the palm of my hand. It's got to have a little bit of weight to it, and I'm not too picky about it as long as it's flat. What's your record? In 2013, I had a 65-skip toss on the Allegheny River. It was a world record. 65 skips. Wow. How can the judge even count that many skips? It does happen pretty quick. In the tournament itself, there are about five judges, and they're all getting a number. Then they come to a consensus. So what's your secret? I always tell people to try the grip it and rip it method. Just throw it as hard as you can and put a little spin on it. Mackinac Island, Michigan has hosted a stone skipping contest for the past 51 years. News from the world of medicine. Cholesterol and Alzheimer's. In a study of more than 2,000 people, researchers found that those with high LDA, bad cholesterol, levels were more likely than those with lower levels to have early onset Alzheimer's. Past research has shown a similar link between high LDL cholesterol and late-onset Alzheimer's, possibly because APOE4 gene, the largest known genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's, raises cholesterol levels. More research is needed to determine whether high levels of LDA cholesterol actually cause Alzheimer's and whether reducing cholesterol levels can help prevent it. Inhalers may not help mild asthma. According to a study in the New England Journal of Medicine, the low-dose steroid inhalers recommended for patients with mild asthma don't prevent attacks. The drugs do reduce type 2 inflammation, which is believed to be prevalent among asthma patients. But of the nearly 300 people in the study, only 27% had type 2 inflammation, and 67% of the remaining patients had the same number of urgent care visits and episodes of breathing trouble when they took a placebo as when they used a steroid inhaler. While the inhalers are generally safe, they can increase the risk for bone loss, cataracts, and glaucoma. If you have been using steroid inhalers, talk to your doctor before stopping. Smoothies deliver the goods in spinach. Lutein, an antioxidant that may help prevent macular degeneration, the most common cause of irreversible vision loss in seniors, is common in leafy greens, but the way you prepare your veggies will affect your health benefits. To see how much this nutrition was absorbed in various dishes, a Swedish team boiled, steamed, and fried baby spinach, all of which degraded much of its lutein. The best method, even better than eating it raw, was to liquefy the spinach in a smoothie made with milk or yogurt. Take a deep breath in the waiting room. It's not unusual to feel uneasy about a medical appointment, but that anxiety can have a potentially dangerous side effect. A negative mood tends to make you pay less attention, especially to unpleasant topics. For a recent study, nearly 1,450 subjects learned about the flu, cancer, HIV, herpes, and gonorrhea. Those who did a relaxation exercise beforehand absorbed more of their doctor's information. Some easy remedies for nerves: take deep breaths or listen to calming music in the waiting room. You can also bring a friend or family member to take notes for you. Risk of using bug spray. In a study of more than 2,100 men and women, those with higher levels of 3-phenyloxybenzene acid in their urine were 50% more likely to die from heart disease than those with lower risk. Their risk of dying from cancer and other causes was also increased. This chemical is associated with exposure to pyrethroids found in many insect repellents, pet sprays, and anti-lice shampoos, as well as pesticides. While the study doesn't prove causation, you may want to avoid pyrethroid-based products if possible. Look out for alitherin, resmethrin, permethrin, and other common names of pyrethroids in the ingredients list. Protecting grandchildren from medications. Most grandparents don't give much thought to the risk of medications they pose to their grandkids, suggested the U.S. National Poll on Healthy Aging. More than four-fifths of grandparents said that when children were visiting their homes, their pills remained on the same place as usual, often in a cupboard or on a countertop. What's more, many seniors transfer their meds from their original child safety bottles to easy-to-open containers. And when they travel to see grandchildren, 70% reported keeping their medications in their bag or purse, says Preet Melani, M.D., the poll's director. Only a small minority put them in a secure pot, such as a locked cabinet. Medications are a leading cause of childhood poisoning worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. Young kids often ingest them because children tend to put things in their mouths. For older kids, easy access raises the chances of their abusing painkillers or other drugs for recreational purposes. What to do if your grandchild takes your medication? The first step is to call a poison control center, says Dr. Malani. Their staff can help with the initial decision-making, including whether the child needs to be taken to the nearest emergency department. Pap smear options. A new urine test was as accurate as pap smears for detecting the high-risk HPV virus, a major risk for cervical cancer. Larger trials are needed before the test is approved, but it could eventually increase the number of women being screened for the life-threatening disease. Antidepressants reduce diabetes deaths. People with diabetes are 2 to 3 times more likely to have depression than people without diabetes, according to the CDC. And up to 75% of those cases, their depression is undiagnosed and untreated. In a 13-year study, researchers followed 53,412 patients diagnosed with both conditions and found that their taking antidepressants reduced the death rate by up to 35%. Everyday miracles. Guardian angel. And there's a picture of a golden retriever. Looks like it's not a young dog, it's an older dog with its head down and its paws crossed in front of it. 20 years ago, I became involved in pet therapy work with our golden retriever, JJ. After JJ passed away, we got another golden retriever and puppy, who we named JJ's Angel. As she matured and went through obedience training, we realized that she, too, would be a good therapy dog. Angel is 10 now and works every week. She visits 2 hospitals, a daycare for the elderly, and our library. Paws for the reading program. At the library, 6 to 10 dogs lie on the floor, and the kids pick a book to read to a dog. After they finish, they get a trading card with the dog's picture and history. Angel has also helped out at Children's Special Needs Camp. She is so popular that everywhere we go, people recognize her, especially the kids she has worked with. We have some very special things through our pet therapy work. I brought Angel to our local hospital to visit a woman who was completely paralyzed on her right side from a stroke. We spent time with her every week. One day, my husband Jack got Angel up into a chair next to the woman's bed. He asked if she wanted to give Angel a treat. She nodded, and Jack carefully placed the treat in her right hand. Angel gently took the treat. Then the woman raised her right hand and started petting Angel. Her friend was in the room and said, "She hasn't been able to move that hand since she had her stroke." After that, every time we saw the woman, she lifted her left hand. We told her she had to use her right hand, and she would. Somehow it seems appropriate that when Angel visits the hospital, she also performs tricks for the patients with her paws. The best one is when she crouches on the floor, bows her head, and crosses her paws. She stays very still and doesn't move until Jack says, "Amen," and claps his hand. We taught her how to say a prayer. Cover story. The internet. How the internet is spying on you. And it's a picture of the scene from, what is the movie with the movie where the lady is stabbed in the shower and she's screaming. You know the marketeers follow you all around the internet, but you might be surprised to learn who or what else is keeping tabs on your every move. You are being stalked everywhere you go. In your car, on your morning call, walk, even in your own home, by your own TV, in our hyper-connected world, where your phone is always with you, information is being collected and shared every nanosecond. So what you say? I have nothing to hide. Don't be so sure. As privacy expert Bennett Cyphers told a reporter for the New York Times Privacy Project, the only people I've heard say who cares are people who don't understand the scope of the problem. The problem is that while corporations and data brokers are hoovering up all the information they can get their sticky mitts on, there are no laws governing what they can do with that information or whom they can sell it to. That includes things you thought were private, such as health and financial data, as well as your beliefs and daily habits. Someone knowing that you ordered three extra large pizzas with the works for dinner last Friday night may seem harmless enough, but there's a deeper principle at play. As cyber expert Bruce Schneider puts it, privacy is not just about freedom from embarrassment. Privacy is an inherent human right and a requirement for maintaining the human condition with dignity and respect, he says. Yet we do little to block the spies. We click I agree without reading the user agreements. We say we'll do one of those privacy checkups one day, but we never quite get around to it. And that means your personal information can be used against you in future in ways you can't imagine today. So what do you have to worry about, and what can you do to protect yourself? Read on and take notes. At home, televisions. Wrapped in a snuggle, I like to binge on the reruns of The Golden Girls all by myself. Except I'm not really alone. Once every few minutes, my TV beams out a report about what's on my screen to Samsung, the company that made it. Chances are your TV is watching you, too. Ever wonder why TVs are getting so cheap? Manufacturing efficiency plays a role, but it's also because TVs have joined the ranks of websites, apps, and credit cards in the lucrative business of sharing your information. Americans spend an average of 3.5 hours in front of a TV each day, according to an e-marketer. Your TV records may not contain sensitive financial data, but that history is a window to your interests, joys, and embarrassments. And marketers are grabbing it because, legally speaking, we gave our permission when we set up our internet-connected smart TVs. The TV makers sell this information to data brokers, who in turn sell it to advertisers and media companies, who are now able to link up with what you watch, with what you do on your phone, tablet, and laptop, even with what you buy in stores. Marketers can then retarget ads you see on your TV to your computer and phone. They can measure how many people bought their product after seeing their ad. I ran an experiment on my own Samsung TV, as well as new models from Samsung, TCL, Roku TV, Vizio, and LG. I set up each as most people do by tapping OK with the remote to each on-screen prompt. Then, using special software from the Princeton University, I watched how each model transmits data. What I found, some TVs record and send out everything that crosses the pixels on your screen. It's not always you they're after, but your behaviors help create aggregated statistical models of people who act or watch TV the way you do. Still, you might find it unnerving. When I set up my TV, I didn't realize I could say no to any of this. You can change your settings after the fact if you're prepared to hunt around in out-of-the-way menus, such as terms and policies, but it may be worth the hunt. Smart speakers. Alexa is always eavesdropping. So are Siri, Google Assistant, and many other virtual assistants you invite into your home. This is and isn't as creepy as it sounds, although it's true the device can hear everything you say within range of it. Microphones. It is listening for its wake word before it starts recording. Once it hears that, Alexa is the default. But then there are other options. Everything in the following few seconds is perceived to be a command or a request and is sent to and stored on servers in the cloud, where the correct response is triggered. Think of a smart speaker like a dog. It's always listening, but it understands only cookie, walk, or buddy. Everything else goes right over its head. Every time Alexa hears a command, Amazon, its parent company, has just learned something about you. Same with Apple and Google if you use their speakers. Maybe the company learned only that you like to listen to the police, or that you like fart jokes, or that you turn your lights off at 11 p.m. every night. If you were to say, Alexa, where should I bury the body? You're not going to have the police showing up at your door. I know because I tried it. Alexa does make mistakes. Sometimes this can be funny, such as when Alexa hears its wake word on a TV show. Other times it's more serious, including an insistence in 2018 when Alexa mistakenly sent an entire private conversation to a random person's Echo device. Occasionally there are even humans listening to your requests for weather reports or trying to figure out what you meant when you added mangosteens to your shopping list. Sound intrusive? You likely already agreed to it in the app's terms of use when you installed the device. What bits of privacy are you willing to sacrifice for the convenience provided by a smart speaker? If you trust that Amazon's intentions are no more nefarious than getting a better idea of what you want to buy on Prime Day, then you have your answer. If you worry about your private information falling into the hands of the wrong people, then you have another answer. Out in the world, cars. Today's cars are equipped with telematics, monitoring technology that constantly sends vehicle performance and maintenance data and much more to the manufacturer via a wireless transmitter. Cars not only how much we weigh, but also track how much weight we gain. Connect a phone to a car and it knows whom we call and text. But who owns and ultimately controls the data? Drivers usually sign away their rights in a small print clause buried in the purchase or lease agreement. What carmakers are doing with the collected information isn't clear. We know they use it to improve car performance and safety. We also know that they have the ability to sell it to third parties, and unfortunately there is no opt-out feature. I will say one thing. I have a car that apparently does that because when it's time for maintenance, it actually lets me know. Car makers use data to alert us when something needs to be repaired or when our vehicles need service. There it is. But what they don't tell us is that by controlling our data, they can limit where we get that repair or service done. And they are more likely to share our data exclusively with their branded dealerships than with independent repair shops. Imagine visiting a medical specialist and learning that he or she can't access the medical history your doctor maintains. It's easy to imagine car makers discharging fees to independent repair shops that need your data to service your vehicle, leading to higher repair prices. Because of the data estimated value, as high as $750 billion by 2030, car makers have no incentive to release their control. Policymakers, however, have the opportunity to give drivers control. This will let car owners maintain what they've had for a century, the right to decide who fixes their car. Fitness tracker. When all the data these devices collect, steps taken, hours slept, and more, how can you be sure your privacy won't go flying out the window? Health privacy lawyers were designed to keep sensitive information private, but they don't apply to these trackers. While your heart rate probably wouldn't mean a lot to someone who most managed to see it, a wearable that tracks your running routes could provide information of great interest to stalkers or attackers. The menstrual cycle tracking offered on some devices could allow for a significant breach of very private information. All too often, apps and devices collect far more data than necessary. If possible, you should let them collect and store only the data required to give you the feedback you want. For example, if you want to count your steps and heartbeat but have no real interest in your sleeping habits, then turn the sleep tracker off. If you want pace, cadence, and speed information, it's unlikely that any of that will come from your phone's microphone. So if an app asks for access, just say no. Schools. For high school students, participating in school lives means producing a digital trail. Homework assignments, essays, emails, pictures, creative writing, chats with classmates. For many, it is all monitored by the Student Surveillance Service Gaggle. Using artificial intelligence and human content moderators, paid for about $10 an hour, Gaggle policy polices schools for suspicious and harmful content. The goal is to help prevent gun violence and suicides. It plugs into two of the biggest software suites, Google's G Suite and Microsoft 365, and tracks everything. This includes notifications from Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram accounts linked to school email addresses. Gaggle claims to have saved hundreds of lives during the 2018-19 school year. But in the process, Gaggle is subjecting young lives to relentless inspection and charging schools up over $60,000 per year. It's not at all clear whether Gaggle is effective as it claims, or that its relentless surveillance is without long-term consequence for the students it promises to protect. And there's really no way to stop it. Gaggle recommends that the schools get permission from parents and students, but a spokesperson says if a student stops out of Gaggle, then they would not be able to use the school-provided technology. Everywhere, Facebook. My editor Michelle was at a birthday party for her son's friend when another mom mentioned a company she liked, Joy Mode. Minutes later, an ad for Joy Mode appeared on Michelle's Facebook news feed. You already know that every time you like a post, leave a comment, or tag a friend, that gives Facebook even more ammunition to serve up targeted ads. But is Facebook listening to our conversations too? We don't look at your messages. We don't listen to you on our microphone. Doing so would be super problematic for a lot of reasons, says Adam Mosseri, CEO of Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, a CBS interview. The truth is, Facebook tracks us in ways we don't even realize, and is so good at it that we think it's monitoring our conversations. Instead, it uses sophisticated demographics and location data to serve up ads. If you use Facebook to sign into other websites, that gives them even more data about you. So that's one easy habit to stop right away. Google. Gmail has been more important to me than any product I've ever owned. It's where my wife and I first started flirting, and where 14 years and two kids later we send jokes and G-Chat length love notes. It was the center of my professional life for years. It contains the contact information and pretty much everything, everyone I've known, plus a decade full of credit card bills, tax returns, embarrassing pictures, bad jokes, and apologies for those jokes. But stories about tech companies' violations of privacy got me thinking about a scenario that once seemed unimaginable, life without Gmail. Google, after all, has been repeatedly accused of improperly collecting user data. Last year, it paid a $13 million fine to settle a class action lawsuit about its Street View programs, scooping up personal information from people's home Wi-Fi networks. It denied any wrongdoing, and yet I was still giving it the entirety of my inbox. This spring, I started telling friends, family, and coworkers to send email in a new address, hosted by my own personal server. For searches, I started using DuckDuckGo, a Google competitor that doesn't collect user data. I realized I'd been self-censoring my emails for years, keeping certain thoughts out of even personal correspondence due to a fear that they might wind up in a hack or a lawsuit or some advertiser's data dump. The experience of having my data sitting only in a little box on my desk was weirdly thrilling. Online retailers. We all have secret consumer scores, hidden ratings that determine how long we wait on hold when calling a business, whether we can, and I never do that, whether we can return items at a store, or what type of service we receive. A low score sends you to the back of the queue. A high score gets you elite treatment. Little is known about these scores. Most people have no inkling they even exist, and companies are mum about how they come up with them or that they exist at all. A watchdog group called the Consumer Education Foundation wants the Federal Trade Commission to investigate secret surveillance scores generated by a shadowy group of privacy-busting firms that operate in the dark recesses of the American marketplace. The report named 11 firms that rate shoppers, potential renters, and prospective employees. I got my file from one of these firms. Others gave the runaround. The company that cooperated, called SIFT, says its proprietary scoring system tracks consumer behavior with hundreds of companies. My report was shocking. More than 400 pages long, it contained all the messages I'd ever sent to hosts on Airbnb, years of Yelp delivery orders, a log of every time I'd opened the Coinbase app on my iPhone. SIFT knew what I'd ordered chicken tikka masala on a Saturday night in April 3 years ago, and knew about a nightmare Thanksgiving I had in California's wide country, as captured in my messages to the Airbnb host of a rental called Cloud9. The companies gathering this data say they find it valuable for rooting out fraud and increasing the revenue they can collect from big spenders. But the process is far from transparent. You can't necessarily stop companies from gathering information, but if you're curious about what's in your SIFT file, you can request it by emailing privacy@shift.com. Just be aware that after this article was publicized in the New York Times, the company was overwhelmed with requests, so it might not get to yours quickly. You can't prevent all Internet spying, but you may not want to. For example, when you start tapping a web address into your phone's browser and it automatically fills in the rest, or when a shopping site saves what's in your cart. But you can minimize some unwanted spying by taking these steps. If you're worried about your personal information getting lifted, don't hand over your name, address, phone numbers, or email addresses unless the recipient really needs it. If pressed, you can always make something up. Opt for a paper receipt or no receipt other than getting one via text or email, which requires sharing your information and exposes you to possible data breaches, such as those at the Hobby Lobby and Target. If you want companies to stop trying to stop sell you things, stop ads from tracking you by opting out of information collecting. The website simpleoptout.com is a good place to start. Add your phone number to the National Do Not Call Registry at 888-382-1222. Or donotcall.gov. If you prefer your internet search to stay private, browse with Firefox. Its privacy controls are stronger than any other big-name browsers. Or use DuckDuckGo, an alternative service you can easily set as your default search partner at duckduckgo.com. If you're worried about your phone acting as a tracker, turn off location services for all apps except Maps and others that expressly need to know where you are. You can do this in Settings under Privacy and Location. If you're worried about in-home devices listening to or watching you, hunt around in the Devices menu or mobile app for privacy settings so you can opt out. Mute smart speakers when you're not using them. If you're worried about your car knowing too much about you, unfortunately. You can't opt out of your car's built-in computers collecting data, but you can minimize how often you pair your smartphone with your vehicle's information system. If you're worried about being tagged in photos on social media, tell friends you don't want to be tagged and opt out of being automatically tagged in other people's Facebook photos by going to Settings, then Face Recognition. Instagram doesn't use facial recognition. If you're worried about tech giants tracking everything you do, sign out once in a while. For example, make sure you're logged out of Gmail before you watch YouTube. Otherwise, Google will know your viewing habits. And don't use Facebook to sign into other websites. If you're worried that the government isn't doing enough to protect your privacy, Europe has a law that gives people the right to know who shares their personal information and the ability to opt out. A new California law in this country is first step in that direction. If you notice a link that says, "Don't sell my personal information," or something similar, that's why. The law affects all Americans. A national proposal, the Consumer Online Privacy Act, is in Senate waiting review. Health and medicine. He cured his own disease. A medical student battling a deadly disorder finally got a lifetime from his own research. Plus, two more stories of innovative men who work miracles. And there's a picture of somebody writing on a screen here, young man. It was just after Christmas. His name apparently is David Fagabaum's football body, and he's a big, muscular guy with a bunch of abs and muscles. And the next picture shows him with chasmal disease. He has a pot belly, looks like he's been drinking beer by the gallon. It was just after Christmas 2013, and David Fagabaum was hovered a hair above death. He lay in a hospital bed at the University of Arkansas. His blood platelet count so low that even a slight bump to his body could trigger a lethal brain bleed. A doctor told him to write his living will on a piece of paper. David was rushed to a CT scan. Tears streamed down his face and fell on his hospital gown. He thought about the first patient who died under his care in medical school and how her brain had bled in a similar way from a stroke. He didn't believe he'd survive the scan, but he did. David was battling Castleman disease, a rare autoimmune disorder involving immune cells attacking vital organs. And worse, the first time a relapse had threatened his life. Massive shock and awe chemotherapy regimens had helped him narrowly escape death during four previous attacks, but each new assault on his body weakened him. "You learn a lot by almost dying," he says. He learned enough to surprise his doctors by coming up with a way to treat his disease. 6 years later, as he's in remission, he and his wife have a baby girl, and he's devoting his medical career to saving other patients like him. As a boy in Raleigh, North Carolina, David spent Saturday watching the North Carolina State Wolfpack football team with his dad, the team's doctor. At age seven, he was obsessed with becoming a Division I athlete. In middle school, he would wake up at 5 a.m. to go running. The walls of his bedroom were covered with football play charts. He achieved his dream, making the Georgetown University football team as a quarterback. But in 2004, during his sophomore year, his mother died of a brain tumor. His obsessive focus deepened, helping him to learn to appreciate life's precious moments and understand that bad things happen to good people. "I know people far more worthy of miracles than I am who haven't gotten them," he says. David's found a support group for grieving college students at Georgetown called Students of AMF, acronym for Ailing Mothers and Fathers, as well as his mother's initials. David went on to learn a master's degree at the University of Oxford, where he learned how to conduct scientific research so that he could fight the disease that took his mom. The relentless focus and scientific rigor would one day save his life. David entered medical school at the University of Pennsylvania to become a doctor like his father, specifically an oncologist in tribute to his late mother. In 2010, during his third year, he got very sick and was hospitalized for 5 months. Something was attacking his liver, kidneys, and other organs and shutting them down. The diagnosis was idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease, first described in 1954. Castleman presents partly like an autoimmune condition and partly like cancer. It is about as rare as ALS. There are around 7,000 new cases each year in the United States. The disease caught in certain immune signaling molecules called cytokines to go into overdrive. It's as if they're calling in fighter jets for all-out attacks on home territory. In his hospital bay, David felt nauseated and weak. His organs were failing, and he noticed curious red spots on his skin. He asked each new doctor who came to his room what the blood moles meant, but his doctors focused on saving his life and weren't interested in them. They went out of their way to say it didn't matter, David says, but the med student turned patient would prove he was on to something. Patients pick up on things no one else does, sees, he says. Castleman disease struck David four more times over the next 3 years, with hospitalizations that ranged from weeks to months. He stayed alive only through intense chemotherapy. Carpet bombing campaign. During one relapse at Duke University Hospital, his family called in a priest to give him his last rites. After all the setbacks, all the organ failures, all the chemo, David worried that his body would simply break. Yet despite it all, he managed to graduate from medical school. He also founded the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, CDCN, a global initiative to fighting Castleman disease. Through CDCN, he began bringing the world on top capital disease researchers together for meetings in the same room. His group worked with doctors and researchers as well as patients to prioritize the needed to be done soon. Rather than hoping for the right researchers to apply for grants, they recruited the best researchers to investigate Castleman. David also prioritized clinical trials that repurchased drugs the FDA had already approved as safe, rather than starting from scratch with new compounds. Meanwhile, he never knew whether the next recurrence would finally kill him. Staving off relapses meant flying to North Carolina every 3 weeks to receive chemotherapy treatments. Even so, he proposed to his college sweetheart, handing her a letter written by his niece that said in part, "I'm a really good flower girl." "The disease wasn't a hindrance to me," says his now wife, Kathy Fagenbaum. "I just wanted to be together." But in late 2013, Castleman struck again, landing David in that Arkansas hospital. It marked his closest brush with death yet. Before he and Caitlin could send out their save-the-date postcards, David set out trying to save his own life. After examining his medical charts, he zeroed in on an idea that more than 60 years after Castleman's disease was discovered, researchers hadn't yet explored. Well, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to finish that article today because it's rather long. I'll continue it next week, so be sure to listen in because the ending is very good. But we have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so very much for listening.